This podcast is brought to you by NerdWallet. Are you paying for your me time with just any credit card in your wallet? While you shouldn't stop treating yourself, you should start paying with a credit card that has perks. NerdWallet lets you compare top travel credit cards side by side to maximize your spending, some even offering 10 times points on your spending. So what could future you do with better rewards? A free flight? Room upgrades? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Hello, everyone. I'm John Hamm, and welcome to Next Question.
Hey, that's my line. I'm Kitty Couric, and yes, welcome to Next Question. We might as well just dive right into my conversation with the star of the new comedy Confess Fletch, the one and only John Hamm.
Hello.
Hello, John. I'm so happy to see you.
It's so nice to see you. It's been a minute.
I know it has been a minute, and you have been everywhere. You've been hawking the shit out of this movie.
Yeah, you know, it's a labor of love. We put a lot of time and sweat equity into making it, and we're very, very proud of it. And it's, you know, it's the little engine that could. You know, it's in theaters and on streaming as we speak, and people are really enjoying it.
Isn't that great? The Rotten Tomatoes
are all fresh and.
And, the audience,
yeah,
whatever,
it's
you know.
All good. So, you know, we're very pleased because obviously, you know, when you take on a character or a franchise or a film that sort of holds its place in the pantheon of, especially for people my age, you know, as one of their favorite movies, you know, what you don't want to do, there's two things you don't want to do. One, you don't want to ruin it, but two, you also don't want to do some sort of pale imitation of it. So,
right.
I never really wanted to do a Chevy Chase impersonation in this film, and we, Greg Mottola and myself, really kind of worked hard to try to figure out what's our version of this. And all we really did was take it back to the books, and we just decided, like, why don't we just make a pretty faithful adaptation of the novels, because they're really excellent kind of mystery novels. And I feel like the mystery is having a moment at this time with the success of things like Knives Out and Only Murders in the Building,
right,
and Death on the Nile and what have you. It's like there's I think people are finding that those kinds of stories are tremendously satisfying.
Were you a big fan of the original? Because I have to be honest, I love Chevy Chase, but somehow
you missed it.
I did.
Okay,
John, I missed it.
Oh, it was a huge presence in my life. The first film, yes, everything about it. So quotable. Chevy is so funny and so particular and so Chevy. It's unimpeachably good, I think.
Oh, it's me, Dr. Rosenfeld. I'm just here to check out Dan Wick's file. Dr. Rosen, I'm here to get to the records room. It's Dr. Rosen. I want to check the records room. Dr. Rosen.
We also didn't want to get into a nostalgia, you know, situation where,
right,
you know, Chevy's in it and I play his son or some
yeah,
weird thing. You know, we just decided to kind of truly reboot it and take it in a different direction.
See, this is my theory. I think the victim interrupted an art theft. The thief got spooked, bonked her over the head, and then ran.
No amateur sleuthing, please.
Listen, I used to be an investigative reporter of some repute. I could be very helpful in this whole matter.
I used to play the trumpet in high school. I never offered advice to Miles Davis. Shut up and talk.
That's a very confusing combination of commands.
So you went back to the books, which, how many are there?
There's something like 10 or 11 Fletch books, and then there's a spinoff character called Flynn, who is actually in the book Confess Fletch, but for rights reasons, we were not allowed to use that character or that name, so we kind of spun him off into the character played by Roy Wood.
I know Ryan Reynolds tried to do this. Dave Chappelle tried to do it. I mean, this has been something that people have tried to do for a long time. So
Why you, John?
Why you? Why now? Why me? You know, I think part of it is what I was saying. It's really hard to tackle something that exists so prevalent in the minds of people from my generation, really. And we were just fortunate enough or dumb enough to really kind of land on this idea of like, well, we don't have to do the slapstick joke a minute. Wigs and teeth and funny names and funny voices version of this, we can actually just take it back to the original stories. And we got the blessings of Gregory MacDonald and his estate.
Was that hard to do?
It was not easy. They're rightfully so, very protective of Gregory's work. And I got a lovely note from his son after he saw the film, and he just said, you know, my dad would have been so proud. It was really great, and you really captured the spirit of the book.
Well, it was a lot of fun to watch, and I guess Greg Mottola, is that right?
Yes.
Mottola or Mottola?
Yeah, Mottola.
Yeah. I don't know much about him, but I could envision a lot of behind-the-scenes laughs and camaraderie. So what was it like to make it with first of all, I love John Slattery.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah, well, John is his own case. So, you know, we have a history that people can recognize, obviously. But Greg and I actually have, this is my third project I've done with Greg. I worked on a movie with Larry David, and he called Clear History, and then we did Keeping Up with the Joneses with Zach Galifianakis and Gal Gadot. And this is the third one. And, you know, this is the third time I've shot in Boston as well. So it was a tremendous amount of fun to make the movie. That's always a plus when you're making a comedy, if you're actually having fun doing it, which also for me and Greg, as producers on it as well, there's a ton of other things you have to worry about.
Right.
But once we got shooting and once we got it rolling, it was fun. And that's what you're kind of going for is that shorthand of having a good time. And Greg had worked with Marcia Gay before, and I had obviously worked with Slattery before, and I think both of us knew Kyle MacLachlan, and then we were lucky enough to get people like Eugene Merman and Roy Wood and Aidan Meyeri, people that are just fun and funny on their own. And
I imagined you all had a hard time kind of at times, especially, is it Roy, keeping a straight face during some of these scenes?
Roy, it was always fun for me to make Roy break because he's so serious and he's a wildly funny man. But in this character, he was so serious and believably so. He plays the detective that's out to try to solve the case. And it looks like the character I play, Fletch, is guilty. So that's the fun of that.
And I think his sidekick is so funny,
too, Aidan Meyeri plays his sidekick, who's sort of the young...
Like the trainee or
trainee
something,
kind
right?
of deal. And she's very funny. We were lucky to get her. We had Annie Mumolo, who I worked with on Bridesmaids, came along and does a very funny small part. So we were really lucky to get the people we got, and we had a blast making it.
I think of you and your quote-unquote body of work. Let's see how James Lipton-y I can get. But, you know... Obviously, Mad Men. I mean, we'll talk about that in a second. But you are a very talented comedic actor, and you love comedy. I thought you were so funny in 30 Rock. But tell me about sort of your preference. Do you enjoy doing funny better?
Well, I'll say this about that. You know, I'm lucky enough to have credibility on both sides of the aisle, so to speak. So I have, been given the incredible good fortune to have done work with some really talented people on the dramatic side as well as the comedic side. And part of that was getting famous doing such a serious, sort of brooding kind of dramatic work as Don Draper, that I could then pivot off of that. And instead of choosing the things that were offered to me off of that, which were basically versions of the same thing, to actually be able to pivot and say, you know, I'd actually like maybe do something a little goofier and funnier. And then once people were able to see me in that world too, then I could really kind of ping pong back between both sides.
Did you worry, and this is such a cliche question, but I do wonder, and I have asked other actors who've really established such an iconic presence in a role, that it would be hard to break out of the Don Draper mold after that show was over?
You know, I think I recognized that kind of possibility and actively sought to play things against that stereotype, honestly. That's why, you know, if I would have done, you know, another role where I played kind of super serious and period or what have you, I think I would have been lost any credibility in the comedic world, which, as you rightfully point out, is I'm a fan of it, and most of my friends are in that world.
And you would love it.
And yeah. I like doing it. So it was definitely a conscious decision to make sure that I wasn't locked in to doing that.
You know, I think the fact that you really struggled. I mean, the struggling artist moniker actually really fit for you, because it took you a long time to get noticed and to start having things click for you. You went to the University of Missouri, mm-hmm. right? Then you started out, you went back to your old high school and taught, which to me is like a series in and of itself.
Yeah.
John Hamm teaches what? What did you teach?
I taught acting and public speaking and improv. So I taught the entire 8th grade, and then 9th through 11th grade were elective courses.
Did you have fun doing that?
I had a blast. And I mostly went back because I recognized that that school had done so much for me and served in keeping me engaged and keeping me on a achievement-oriented path. And kept me, you know, sane, basically, in a time when my life could have very easily gone in several different directions, and provided me with the artistic input and the spark that I in many places, whether it was athletics or the theater or academics, it was all you were encouraged to succeed and to achieve at all of those things, and I just found that to be a really healthy and wonderful place to be. So I really wanted to kind of have that experience for another generation, and I was fortunate enough to really be able to do it. Ellie Kemper being the most visible of my former students, but I have quite a few of them that I'm tremendously proud of.
And so you went from teaching at your alma mater, and then you took off for Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
and it was a slog, right, John?
Yeah, you know, it's a very strange. It's a very strange transition to drive west from St. Louis, Missouri, and then find yourself in Los Angeles and really realize that not only are you a very small fish in a very big pond, but that pond is a small part of a larger ocean, and you don't really have any kind of survival skills whatsoever. So it was a real tricky and challenging transition to realize that, you know, okay, this might not happen overnight.
Did you take acting classes once you got there?
I did. I enrolled in a class or two. And
Kaminsky method?
Not quite, but I did, you know, I was in class with a lot of working actors and a lot of people that I recognized from TV, and you know, it wasn't inexpensive, so I had two or three jobs, you know, and it was just, it was hustling, it was surviving, you know, and I knew a little bit about that. That's was kind of my go-to, you know, ethos for a long time. So fortunately, I had a really good group of friends that kind of were all in the same boat.
Like Paul Rudd.
Paul was in a very different boat, very nice, nicely appointed luxury liner at that point. But Paul was there too, and Paul was was sort of the proof of concept. Like, look,
and you all knew each other from St. Louis, or knew because you were both from St. Louis, you connected.
Well, Paul's from Kansas City. I'm from St. Louis. So I knew Paul because his roommate at the University of Kansas was the older brother of a friend of mine from high school. So he would come back for holidays and weekends, what have you. Paul was sort of like there as the example of like, oh, well, maybe it could happen. You know, you don't have to be the son of somebody famous, or I guess you kind of do now, it seems like, but, nepotism wasn't quite what it is, now back then.
You had this idea that if I'm not in it, or if I'm not making it by the time I'm 30, I'm going to pack my bags and figure out something.
Yeah, I gave myself 5 years. And at that point, that would have been, I was 25 when I moved to LA. That would have been a sixth of my life, what have you, 20%, 17% of my life. And that's enough time, I thought, to like establish some kind of plan, put it in action, see if it works. And it was. I turned 30 on the set of my first movie. I was paying my bills being an actor. I had paid off my student loans. I wasn't working in a restaurant or bartending for the first time in a decade. And I was like, okay, this seems to be working, you know. In the first 3 years that I was in LA, I auditioned for tons of things, but it didn't, nothing hit.
And did you do small roles or commercials?
I mean, nothing. I was an extra. I was an extra in the pilot of The Practice. You know, I had a featured extra role in Ally McBeal where I didn't have any lines. I was just the guy at the bar. Nothing substantial and nothing that was able to pay my bills for years. And finally, I got, you know, a part that I had to talk, and then I got a little more.
What was your first speaking role?
The first thing that I had that was of any consequence was a role on a TV show that was on NBC. On Friday nights called Providence, and it was
I remember that with Maria Kanasarada.
Maria Kanakaridis, yes. Thank you. That was the first thing I learned is how to pronounce the star's name.
And by the
very
way,
important.
Beautiful, lovely person.
Lovely lady.
Don't I know you?
You remember me?
Yeah, you're the bartender. What are you doing here?
Fireman by day, bartender by night.
I had a one-time guest spot on that probably paid me more money than I had made the entire year. And they asked me to come back for 13 episodes. And then they asked me to come back for 7 more episodes. And I was like, this is the gift that keeps on giving. This is just great. And then I got another part and smaller things here and there. And then I got a series regular on a Lifetime television show called The Division, starring Bonnie Bedelia and Taraji Henson and Nancy McKee and Lisa Vidal, Tracy Needham. Amy Jo Johnson. We had a great cast.
No, I do not do group. I buy my own tickets.
Come on, but you got 20 times the chance of winning.
Right. Remember that woman that bought those tickets last month? Yeah, she's supposed to collect for the whole office and buy the tickets, and then she said she bought one more that was supposedly the one that won all the money? Yeah, I'm not even going there. No. I lotto alone.
And it just got a little bit easier to push the rock up the hill every day. And so that led to, you know, more and more opportunities and movies and things and pieces and parts and whatever until I was finally in the running for a show called Mad Men, and that was in 2005. That was 10 years after I moved to LA, and it only took 10 years to be an overnight success.
When we come back, John shares the funny story of how he found out that he had landed that gig.
This podcast is brought to you by NerdWallet. Are you paying for your me time with just any credit card in your wallet? While you shouldn't stop treating yourself, you should start paying with a credit card that has perks. NerdWallet lets you compare top travel credit cards side by side to maximize your spending, some even offering 10 times points on your spending. So what could future you do with better rewards? A free flight? Room upgrades? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Was it hard to secure that part as Don Draper? Were other people considered? Because to me, sitting across from you and just knowing you a bit, I mean, I feel like you were born to play that
role.
Yeah,
you know, I've heard rumors of who was being, you know, looked at. Everyone from Thomas Jane to, I don't know, who else. But, you know, there was no... I had auditioned 7 or 8 times, I think, you know, that nobody wanted me because I was not a known quantity. I wasn't a name. I wasn't a star. I wasn't a, you know, a TV proven thing, whatever, even though I had worked for the past 5 years or so consistently. But, you know, sometimes it takes time. And I remember I got the part in an elevator in Tribeca at the Gansevoort Hotel. After my final audition, and I had drinks with on the roof of the Gansevoort with all the executives, and I was kind of like, this, no one's told me I have this yet. I don't know what's going on here, but I'm being treated like I have it, but I haven't seen a contract. What's happening? And so finally we're on the elevator going down after this drink session, and the executive turns to me and says, you know you got the part, right? And I said, no, I didn't. Thank you for telling me. No one explicitly told me this. So it was that was the day. And I happened to be riding in the elevator with a very famous German soccer star named Franz Beckenbauer. And the elevator, she just told me this. I had no idea he was on the elevator or who he was. But the doors opened and there were all these people like waiting and cheering and everything. I was like, wow, they really did a number here. This is really cool. But of course, they were waiting for the superstar football man.
That's funny. And I mean, I just still love watching Mad Men.
It was
such an incredible show, incredible cast, so stylish. And do you think that Mad Men could get made today? Because, you know, I don't think it's, you know, it's not like a superhero.
Right.
It's just very...
It's a funny thing. I don't think Mad Men could have been made 5 years before it got made, and I don't think it probably could have been made 5 years after. I think it just happened to come along right at the right time. It didn't look like anything else. It didn't act... The show wasn't about cops or firemen or lawyers or doctors, so it didn't have... Or gangsters or what have you. It was... The stakes in the world that we were playing were not the life and death stakes that most television deals in, right?
Right.
So it wasn't Tony Soprano or Walter White or this or you know ER or what have you or NYPD Blue. You know, it was real life, and it was portrayed so as you say, stylishly and beautifully that I think that's how that's how those stakes were brought, and there were things that people could recognize, you know, things like your marriage dissolving or your career not going the way you want it to, or you getting everything you want, and what does that mean? How does that work? Or struggling with, you know, whatever is going on in your life, and it was played in a real way and not in a corny or schmaltzy way either. So I think it came along right at the right time. I don't know if it would be, if it was made today, people wouldn't pay attention.
I don't know. It's just such a iconic show. And I think for me, I liked watching it because of the gender politics in the office.
Exactly.
As somebody who had to kind of muscle my way into a male dominated industry. You know, of course, I love Peggy and Joan and seeing sort of all those dynamics. And I think, you know, it made me really appreciate how far we've come.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there was an element of that was really appealing to me. Do you keep in touch with all those folks? Obviously, you and John are good friends.
Yeah, you know, there's a text thread that gets hit up every now and again, or, you know, if one of us goes through a life moment, you know, there'll be a congratulations or what have you. But yeah, we're I wouldn't say we're super close, but we're as close as you probably imagine. And it was a pleasure to get to have John come on our film and play my former boss, which was sort of a nod and a wink, obviously, to our past. But it was great to be in a scene with him again. You know, he's a wonderful actor and he's a great guy. And
Elizabeth Moss is kind of on fire.
Moss is killing it.
You know,
she's become a cottage industry and she's doing her thing. And, you know, it's really great. You know, it's Christina.
I was at a wedding with Christina.
Yeah, Christina's had a really nice run with Good Girls. And, you know, everybody's kind of doing their thing. And
I always see people from Mad Men popping up in different shows. And I'm like, wait, there's what's his name
exactly,
from Mad Men,
exactly.
You know?
It's nice. You know, it's nice. We root for each other for sure. And that's a great, you know, it's a great to have that kind of history. Honestly, it's for better, for worse. It was a decade out of our lives, you know, and that we spent kind of constantly together, whether we were either shooting the show or promoting the show or on the awards circuit or what have you. So it's a really worthwhile thing to have in your life. And it's not something you want to let go that easily.
You know, obviously, John, I've interviewed you before and read a lot about you, and in preparing for the interview today, I forgot about your mom. And then I remembered that you were only 10 when you lost your mom.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think 20 when you lost your mm-hmm. dad. And, you know, it's lately I've been reading and thinking a lot about generational trauma and how that term has expanded
uh-huh.
to not just sort of slavery and the Holocaust,
right.
which of course is the ultimate
right.
sort of generational trauma, but just the idea of enduring a significant loss or having something traumatic happen to you as a child and the impact that had on you then and how much it colors your adult relationships.
For sure, for sure.
And I know that I think it's so cool that you have been really exploring that. It's amazing to me that we weren't thinking about that even a few years ago, about the incredible impact your childhood does have on your adult life.
Yeah. I mean, it's the foundation, you know, you're a different, literally a different human being. You're made differently at that age than you are as an adult. You're not fully cooked in many ways. You know, your neural pathways are wide open when you're younger, and it's all of these things are still working themselves out. So to have that kind of traumatic experience, and you're right, it doesn't have to be abuse or anything like you said, you know, but the other kinds of that are very real as well. And, you know, my mom died essentially of colon cancer.
Right.
And obviously I know that that's a big part of your existence. It's very much part of mine. I tell everybody in my world that's get a colonoscopy yesterday, because it's all of that is easily preventable.
And your mom must have been really young, pretty
35,
young.
35 years old. And obviously that wasn't anywhere near time for her to be screened or anything like that.
Right.
It was just a very much an outlier, you know, like cancer is. Sometimes it just happens and it's a bummer. But, you know, it's something that does, as you say, leave a mark, you know, and it, I think that the reason recently it's been a little more forward in people's minds is because we kind of all had a major trauma over the last couple of years with the pandemic. And we all went through this kind of global weirdness that I think we're all still, it's just now, you know, walking in the city and you're just now kind of like, oh, everyone kind of feels a little bit back to normal.
Right, but there's something in the air that still doesn't feel quite normal, right?
I feel like it is. It's a combination of the very strange Trump era, amplified by the very strange pandemic. And there's no, you know, comparison to either of those things, really. They're both incredible outliers. And so I think that's, everyone's kind of thinking about how all of that is not only affecting them, but affecting their kids. And I've had plenty of friends of mine's kids that their senior year or their freshman year in college or whatever was remote, and they don't get to see their friends, and they don't get to have a graduation. And I'm just like, gosh, that sucks. You know, that just sucks because of this weird thing that we had no control over. I mean, it's like an asteroid hit the planet or something. It's just all of a sudden we can't go out for a year.
Yeah.
Like that was weird. And processing that is going to take a minute.
You hope it teaches kids resilience and sort of how to adjust and sacrifice. But you're right. I think it was really, really difficult and heartbreaking for a lot of kids and a lot of adults, too.
A lot of adults.
And a lot of elderly people who declined so rapidly because they didn't have the social interaction.
The social part of our day-to-day existence, having that completely removed or completely replaced, I should say, with some semblance of, if you're lucky enough to have a computer or Wi-Fi or whatever, you could Zoom or you could FaceTime or things like that. But I remember early on in the pandemic calling all of my friends or FaceTiming all my friends. Like, I've talked to you more in the last like 6 months than I have in the last 6 years, because there isn't it's a replacement for what was just normal life of seeing people. Like, no, I think I'll call my friend, see him. How's he doing? You know, what time is it in Australia? Like, you know.
So I think you're right. Maybe that has sort of spurred more interest in how events in one's lives, you know,
have an impact.
Yeah,
for sure.
And reemerge often in how you interact with people. And I'm just curious, John, and if you don't feel comfortable talking about it, we don't have to, but do you remember much about your mom and your mom's illness? Because obviously, you know, when my husband got sick and died 9 months later, I mean, like, I remember almost every detail of that.
I remember a lot of it. You know, I just remember how sudden it was. You know, I remember it being my mom one day and then not my mom one day. You know, just how rapidly the illness spread. And, you know, spending so much time in a hospital at that young age was very strange to me. And my only experience with hospitals was old people at that point. Certainly not my mom, who was 35 years old. That's not old, although when you're 9, that's ancient.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it was like the hospitals are for old people. That's what hospitals are for. And so it was a very strange, you know, kind of disconnect and jarring. And then by the end, my mother had the cancer really spread throughout her whole abdomen and all of her major organs. And you know, she was a shell of herself. And there wasn't any support network in the early 80s. Mental health was what they called crazy people. Like that
right.
was, you know, if you needed some mental health work, that meant you were going in the rubber room.
And it was just you and your dad? Did
it was
you have
me
siblings?
And my dad, and I had two half-sisters who both lost their mother very young as well. And, you know, aunts and uncles and whatnot, an extended family. But it was, the vocabulary certainly wasn't there. And people didn't know how to talk about that. I was given a book that said, What to Do with it When a Parent Dies, written by some psychologist, I guess, or social worker, which I read. But, you know, that's not really what you need. You
no.
need to talk and have people explain and understand and really, you know, and for
especially
many people
in
at
an
that
age appropriate way,
that's your first introduction in many ways to permanence, you know, is death. And most people, it's their dog or their
grandmother,
goldfish or their grandma, right? Or what have you. And to have it be this close and have it really settle, it was my part that I don't remember so much is the aftermath.
Mm-hmm.
The next couple years are very foggy for me. And then once I started at the school that I eventually went back to teach, that got me back into a pattern where I was like, okay, now I'm starting to feel like I'm coming out of that fog.
10 is a tough age to a 10-year-old boy.
Yeah.
And,
got a lot of energy. You know, you got a lot of...
But also you're very, you know...
You're
my
still
girls,
a little boy.
My girls were 2 and 6. And, you know, Ellie was... obviously aware, and her dad walked her to school every day and made her breakfast and did her hair and all that. Not very well, by the way, but you know, I think 10, you know, you're kind of in the world. And,
yeah.
And I remember thinking, and those are very like that pre-adolescent adolescent
yeah.
stage is so tender and fragile. And mm-hmm. so that must have been tough.
Yeah.
Did you feel like your dad probably had a hard time dealing with
oh,
it, as
sure.
you said. People
he was
didn't
also,
know how to do.
He was, his first wife passed away very suddenly as well. So, you know, he was dealing with a lot of stuff that, again, no vocabulary, no infrastructure to help, no mental health checks, no, none
and
of that
it was
that,
still
really.
Taboo to not only kind talk of. About death, John, but really to talk about cancer.
Cancer, depression, feelings, you know, a lot of that was, you know, we're still in the post-war. You know, my grandfather fought in World War II, and I remember going through, when I was probably in my late teens or even early 20s, some of his photo albums from back then. You know, handsome guy in the Navy, and the, you know, the outfit and
yeah.
thing. And I was like, oh man, where were you? I was like, oh, we're in the Philippines. I was like, Philippines went in World War II. And you're like, oh yeah, like that was a brutal part of World War II. Like the Pacific Islands were not, it wasn't suntans and surfing. It was a lot of like death and destruction. And he just wouldn't talk about it. He just would say a lot of bad things happened there. And that was
yeah.
it.
Your dad died at when you were 20.
Yeah.
And so you were sort of an orphan.
Not sort of.
You were an orphan.
Yeah.
yeah. You were an orphan when your dad died when you were just 20.
Yeah.
And that must have left you feeling pretty unmoored, to
yeah,
say the
for
least.
Sure. For sure. It was.
You were in college still.
I was in college, and it was sort of like I was my grandmother had passed away about 8 months beforehand, and that's where I was living. And so I was sort of moved out of my house while I was in college and came back, and all my stuff was in my sister's basement. That's where I lived. And then my dad died. So I was very much, that's when I really leaned on my community. And that was when my friend's parents, and
they all sort of adopted you, right?
Pretty much, yeah. That's when I really realized that, okay, not only do I need help, my sister was like, you need to see a professional, you need to talk to somebody, and you need to, you know, somehow get back on your feet. And part of that was getting a job, you know, recommitting to school, and really kind of understanding in some way what was going on. You know, what was happening now and what had happened, but what do you want? What do you want your life to look like? Because start working on it, because it'll go by fast if you don't. And that's when I really, that was, you know, in a lot of ways was like, okay, it was a gut check. You know, a lot of people don't get that till way later in life, but mine came then, and it was time to kind of get back on the horse and really get going.
We'll be right back. This podcast is brought to you by NerdWallet. Are you paying for your me time with just any credit card in your wallet? While you shouldn't stop treating yourself, you should start paying with a credit card that has perks. NerdWallet lets you compare top travel credit cards side by side to maximize your spending, some even offering 10 times points on your spending. So what could future you do with better rewards? A free flight? Room upgrades? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
I feel like you have really started in a very significant way delving into the impact of your mom's death and later your dad's death. And, you know, there's a guy named Terry Real who I've interviewed who talks about the adaptive child versus the wise adult, mm-hmm. and some of the impulses you have that harken back to when you were much younger. And I'm just curious, you know, what are you learning about yourself, John, through your work, through therapy, that has helped you in forging your relationships today?
Sure. Part of that is you know, when you lose parents at a young age, the loss of them is processed like an abandonment. Even though it's obviously that's of no, not their choice.
You right.
know, it's the choices made by the universe, but you're adaptive child brain doesn't think of it that way. It feels abandoned. And so you experience this loss, it's almost like a cutout shape, right? And you just don't have it anymore. But you can't quite process why. And that stays with you. And so, as you say, it reflects itself in your relationships and your ability to, you know, be in a loving relationship or let yourself be vulnerable or let yourself be loved or taken care of or anything. And that's a tough pattern to break. And it takes... It really just takes, I'm not going to try to make this sound like it's easy, but it really takes the awareness to identify what it is and to identify how you are actually processing that, and then don't.
Actually, well, you have lean to almost you have to kind of almost rewire your brain,
exactly.
But also,
but you have
I
to
imagine,
identify. It. You have to identify it first.
You have know? To stop yourself in your tracks at time and say,
why am I pushing this away?
Or why am I reacting this
or
way?
Or why am I looking for this other thing? Why is a big, when you can come up with the reason why, then you can actively or effectively counteract it if it's something that's not healthy. And so that's been a big part of my kind of unpacking of a lot of all that stuff is understanding that, okay, some of that stuff is a survival mechanism, right? You talk about adaptive children. Well, the kids are very famously can,
right.
you know, find their way through any situation. But it doesn't necessarily mean that that's always good for them. You know, if you talk to survivors of atrocities or things when they were kids, they're holding on to that stuff, even though they survived it and they adapted to their surroundings or abuse or, you know, whatever. But you have to really understand that surviving something is not
overcoming it
and learning from it.
Yeah. Well, so you how are you feeling on like the healthy and whole spectrum these days, mentally
pretty
and emotionally?
Good. You know, I'm for me, the pandemic was actually, you know, I hate to say this. It's always like you say, I had a pretty nice pandemic. But I got to, I worked a lot, which was good. You know, I basically strengthened a relationship with my girlfriend, Anna, throughout that. It was sort of like a trial by fire. A lot of people's went the other way.
Yeah.
But the pandemic was an amplifier, I think, for good and bad. And for our case, it was good. And, you know, I'm looking forward to whatever the next phase is. You know, I'm very present in that and understanding that, you know, none of that stuff comes without real awareness and work on it and paying attention. That's a big part of it. You can get distracted so easily in the business that we're in. There's so many shiny things, right? There's a party to go to and an award show and a this and a that and the next job and the next challenge. And you can get so distracted that it's helpful to center and remind yourself that, you know, everything you have is really nice. And maybe don't worry about what you don't have.
Amen. Amen, brother. So do you think you'll ever have kids? I'm just curious. I mean, is that when you looked ahead at your life plan, was that something that was in the picture or was it?
I mean, it's my life. I've never had a life plan. You know, that's
well,
another
you did.
Part of
you
my.
Said, you said by 30, if this
well,
isn't going to work.
True,
so.
But that's an if then, I guess. I never really had a roadmap because I never everything was always so unstable.
Right.
And now that things have stabilized and I'm comfortable in my career and I'm comfortable in my life. Yeah. You know, I would love to have kids. I think it would be great. You know, I'd be a good, I just saw George Clooney. He was on Drew Barrymore right before me. And I was like, oh yeah. Like he's a good old dad. Like there's good old dads. I'd be a good old dad. Why not?
I think you'd have a lot of fun because I think you're fun and funny and it would be, you know, there's nothing like kids in terms of, you know, you talk about shiny objects. Boy, they set your priorities pretty quickly.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. And in the best way, I think, too.
No,
you know,
no,
taking
I
care
agree.
Of something is great, you know, is a great reason to get up in the morning for sure.
Are you, speaking of shiny objects, do you have something you're doing next professionally or?
I'm currently working on
the morning show.
Wait,
we have to talk about that for a second. The morning show.
Something I'm sure is very near and dear to your heart.
I mean, so have you shot some episodes?
We've shot a few.
Let me guess, you're an Anchorman.
I'm not actually.
No?
Strangely enough, no, I don't play an Anchorman. I can't really get into who I play, but
really?
But
can you give us a little hint?
I wish I could. No, I don't want to spoil anything. But I suffice to say, I get to work with Jen Aniston and Reese and Billy Crudup and the whole gang over there, all of whom are really wonderful actors, and it's a real treat to get to be in scenes with pros. You know,
right.
And at this point in my career, it's like a nice. It's nice to be invited to play with the A team, and. Yeah, we're here in New York City. We're going to shoot some exteriors for the show, and
are you shooting some scenes also in New York?
I think
or?
So. I'm not. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I think if whatever we do will be outdoors. Looks like we got some beautiful weather for it. And Juliana's in it. She's wonderful. She's a longtime friend of mine as well. I love her. So yeah, you know, I'm doing that. When I wrap that in a month or so, I'll go up to Canada to do season 5 of Fargo.
Oh,
So, you know,
wait, were you in earlier seasons of Fargo?
No,
because I was like, I don't remember you in that.
That's kind of what I look for when I look at TV stuff is sort of things I can get into and get out of. You know, it's one season here, one season here.
You don't want sort of a repeat
the decade long job holds less of a thrill for me than it once did. But and then hopefully we'll get to make some more Fletches down the line. There's nine or 10 more books. I'd love to get to the one where he goes to Rio. I hope
yeah,
we get to do that,
that
one.
Would be
that
fun.
Would be awesome. But there's plenty more stories, and they're all really fun and funny and intriguing and they're satisfying. You know, they're whodunits, and when you tell one of those stories, as I said, they're having a moment right now. So I think people are finding that the mysteries, when they're solved, are satisfied.
And also it's just great escapism. And it's also
a little bit of a change from, like, when you see a story that where actions have consequences and things make sense at the end, and then that's talk about wish fulfillment. You know, like, I just wish that the real world would work like that every now and again, where people would have to actually own up to what they did and pay for it.
Who could you be talking about, Mr. Hamm?
I can't imagine who I might be thinking of.
Well, it's really fun to see you. I'm so glad things are going so well.
It's my pleasure. It's always a pleasure to see you.
I've always been a big fan. Thank you for your help with Stand Up to Cancer.
Of course.
Thank you for spreading the word about colonoscopies and other forms of screening. I did a Cologuard commercial because, you know, colonoscopies are great if, A, you do them.
Yes.
And there are some obstacles.
There's a rough day, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, you know.
It's not as bad as it once was.
Yeah, and I also say it's much better than being diagnosed with colon cancer. My attitude is the best test is the one that gets done. So for whatever reason, if you can't miss work and you want something to even be in, you know, between colonoscopies, Cologuard is a big option. By the way, this wasn't a commercial, but I just wanted to explain why I was happy to support what they do.
All of that stuff is so important. And it's so, you know, again, I talk about my mom, you know, in the 70s, it just didn't exist. And the idea of preventative medicine in any kind of way was like kind of a hippy-dippy
thing. I remember my neighbor ate yogurt, and I thought that was super weird.
Yeah, give me a break, hippie, right? and really, you know, health food was kind of the punchline.
Right, remember that? It was like, what?
Health food. Who wants to be healthy? It's, you know, and in the Midwest, it was kind of amplified.
Oh, I'm sure, you know. Do they have those Drews?
Ted Drews. Oh.
I had a Ted Drews. Oh. You turn it upside down, it doesn't come out. Concrete.
Yeah, yeah,
they
for sure.
They are good. They're good. And probably not very good for you, though, John.
Listen.
But everything in moderation.
Yeah. Everything in moderation. They are delicious.
But it's not only, you know, not only our understanding of prevention, but just some of the things they have. In terms of diagnostic tools and treatments, I mean, cancer care has come a long way.
I come from a family of, my dad had diabetes when he was 30 years old. My grandmother had diabetes. Like, my mom's side of the family has cancer all over it. I just, why not? If you're going to find it early. It's better than finding it late.
That's for damn
and
sure.
Diabetes is the same thing. You know, it's one of those things that there's markers and there's things that they know are precursors. And if you just pay attention to them. Part of that is what I was saying too. You know, if you just pay attention to what your life is telling you, you can actually, it's a lot less stressful.
It's true. It's true. What is an ounce of prevention?
An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And that's so true.
Yeah. Well, Sean, thank you for doing this.
What a pleasure.
It's nice because it doesn't sound like you're tired of talking about this stuff, which is really nice. No, because you've been running around town.
It's always a pleasure to see you. You put a smile on my face every time I see you. But it's nice to have a conversation with regular people.
Yeah. So. Good. All right. Thanks, John.
My pleasure.
Confess Fletch is out now. And if you want to know where to watch it, do what I do. Google it. Next Question with Katie Couric is a production of iHeartMedia and Katie Couric Media. The executive producers are me, Katie Couric, and Courtney Litz. The supervising producer is Lauren Hansen. Associate producers, Derek Clements and Adriana Fazio. The show is edited and mixed by Derek Clements. For more information about today's episode or to sign up for my morning newsletter, Wake Up Call, go to katiecouric.com. You can also find me at Katie Couric on Instagram and all my social media channels. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.